Benvinguts a aquesta nova edició dels debats d'educació. Benvinguts tots els que sou aquí i també tots els que ens seguiu a través de video streaming. Per començar, com sempre, hem d'agrair al MACBA la seva col·laboració en els debats d'educació des de ja fa molt de temps, que ens permet doncs, gaudir d'aquesta magnífica sala i també ens permet gaudir de l'enregistrament de l'acte. Per als que no sou habituals, dir-vos que Debats d'Educació és una iniciativa de la Fundació Jaume Bofill i també dels Estudis de Psicologia i Ciències de l'Educació de la Universitat Oberta de Catalunya. Debats d'Educació té com a objectiu fonamental oferir un espai de debat obert a la participació de la ciutadania en general i molt especialment de la comunitat educativa, però entesa en un sentit extens. És un espai que vol servir també a la sensibilització dels principals actors socioeconòmics, polítics i, de fet, a la cultura del nostre país. En un context de canvi accelerat, com el que ens toca viure, Debats d'Educació pretén abordar temes d'actualitat, però també intenta identificar qüestions de fons que volem no perdre de vista per poder mirar amb confiança a l'educació del futur. Amb una trajectòria que ja portem doncs, llarga, de més de 10 anys, Debats d'Educació ha pogut incorporar la perspectiva de persones del nostre context més immediat i, de fet, continuem fent-ho, però també mantenim l'ambició d'oferir el contrast que podem obtenir d'altres òptiques i experiències provinents del context internacional. Aquesta ha estat, de fet, la intenció de les darreres ponències dels debats d'educació i molt concretament de l'última, que va portar a terme en Doug Lemov el passat mes d'abril, en què ens va ajudar a identificar alguns dels punts que cal tenir en compte, els punts forts que cal tenir en compte a l'hora de buscar l'excel·lència en l'activitat docent. De fet, aprofitant la seva intervenció d'aquí a 15 dies, tal com ja hem començat a fer de manera sostinguda, després del debat portarem a terme un seminari web en què, a partir de la reflexió d'alguns especialistes, us convidem, de fet, a tots a participar en la discussió, en aquest cas, sobre les opcions de què disposem per la millora de la pràctica docent, principalment en les situacions més desafavorides, no? Us ho recordaré, però, al final d'aquest acte, novament, us en donaré, de fet, aleshores uns quants detalls més, perquè ara el que voldria immediatament és no entretenir-vos i donar pas immediatament a la nostra convidada d'avui, que ens permetrà, tal com us deia abans, una vegada més, complir amb aquest objectiu de portar la perspectiva, una altra perspectiva procedent del context internacional, en aquest cas per abordar des de la seva valuosa experiència el repte que suposa encara a dia d'avui mantenir l'escola pública com un mecanisme eficaç de cohesió social en una societat tan complexa com és la nostra. Abans de donar-li la paraula, però, serà l'Ismael Palacín, el director de la Fundació Jaume Bofill, qui us presentarà la Melissa Bent, la nostra ponent.
Molt bé. Moltes gràcies, Josep Maria. You're welcome, Melissa. Thanks for sharing your point of view with us. Faré una presentació breu fent servir paraules de la pròpia Melissa. En primer lloc, la primera entrada seria el context britànic de lluita que ens explicarà la Melissa pel model d'escola. És possiblement molt diferent al que vivim aquí, però potser no tan diferent. És a dir, les tensions a les que es veu i es veurà sotmès al sistema escolar tenen moltíssimes analogies i potser els propers anys encara en tindran més. És a dir, a mesura que la millora educativa pren importància per l'economia, per les aspiracions de les famílies. L'educació veiem com es veu sotmesa a noves tensions, a creixents tensions de diferenciació, de desigualtat, de copagament i potser també de privatització. I en aquests darrers períodes al nostre país hem vist el que poden ser uns principis d'això i la Melissa ens parlarà d'un context on això forma part d'un debat obert, d'una guerra escolar que diu ella. L'educació pública a vegades ens diuen que s'ha de renovar o morir, però precisament el debat d'avui és renovar-se en quina direcció, i abans la Melissa em deia, i el que segur que té clar és en quina direcció no s'ha de renovar o en quina direcció està plena de perills. La Melissa és escriptora britànica, és activista per l'educació comprensiva i pública de qualitat. El seu punt de vista comença dient que l'escola pública a Europa ha donat oportunitats úniques als seus ciutadans i ha afavorit la mobilitat social i l'oportunitat d'una vida digna i de qualitat. I el seu treball se centra en desmentir el tòpic d'un model d'escola pública fracassada, mostra que és possible crear escoles públiques d'alt rendiment acadèmic per tothom i reivindica l'educació més que mai com un factor de reducció del classisme d'origen. El seu punt de partida diu que l'educació pública està en perill i precisament és un punt de vista que defensa, fa una crida en defensa d'un model d'escola que no generi ciutadans de diferents categories. I això té a veure amb el debat que ens obre sobre la mercantilització, sobre la fi de l'escola inclusiva o el principi d'una escola segregada. La Melissa Benn es va graduar a Història a la London School of Economics, va treballar al Consell Nacional per les Llibertats Civils, va ser secretària d'Estat de Salut, investigadora de l'Open University, és escriptora, periodista, ha escrit molts articles sobre educació, mitjans de comunicació, i ha escrit obres que podeu trobar com Education and Democracy o A Comprehensive Future, Quality and Equality for All Our Children, o el llibre que avui també dona títol a la conferència, que és School Wars, The Battle for Britain's Education, i School Myths, que és el darrer de 2015. Aquests són uns llibres que han obert, que han entrat en un debat punyent, en un debat molt intens, i ha obert encara han amplificat potser la controvèrsia i el debat sobre les contradiccions del model escolar britànic. És fundadora de la xarxa d'escoles locals del Regne Unit, que és una xarxa que promou les escoles públiques locals al Regne Unit i per corregir els mites i mentides que es difonen sobre aquests centres educatius i per remarcar els seus èxits. I aquesta xarxa, us els menciono breument, però té quatre eixos fonamentals. El primer diu que tots els nens tenen dret a anar a una escola pública excel·lent, cada escola pública ha de tenir un procediment d'accés just, cada escola pública ha de ser sensible a les necessitats dels alumnes i als desitjos dels seus pares i mares, a més de rendre comptes a la comunitat local, i que les escoles públiques en dificultats han de ser recolzades per millorar i no atacant-les i desmoralitzant els seus usuaris. En aquest context tan intens hi trobarem molts ressons que ens poden ajudar a pensar com orientar els nostres debats, les nostres opcions, en uns temps en què jo estic convençut que l'educació al nostre país serà més important que mai, però potser precisament per això es veurà sotmesa a més cobdícia, a vegades a més debat, a més tensions i a més pressions que mai. Us animo a escoltar amb la Melissa, activant d'alguna manera ja el cervell a l'hora de pensar on estan les analogies amb la nostra realitat, perquè després en el debat obert tindrem oportunitat per animar-la a discutir amb nosaltres sobre quin pot ser les nostres opcions i el nostre futur. Moltes gràcies, Melissa.
Thank you very much. I don't know, is this on? Yes, you can hear me. Okay. The first thing I want to say is it's very exciting for me to be in Barcelona. I've never been to Barcelona before. I arrived at the airport an hour ago, and lovely it is to talk to all of you. I'm looking forward to actually seeing some of the city. The second thing, which I hadn't realised, is how very, very strange it would be to be introduced and not understand a word. So I have no idea what you've just been told about me. I hope you were told that I'm a person of honesty and with something interesting to say. And I'm also very much hoping that what you think I'm going to say tallies with what I am going to say. Because I've spent the last week reflecting particularly on what's been happening in England, but I'm going to look at it in a European and a global context. And that's what I'm going to do. So if these two wonderful gentlemen said I was going to do something else, well, I was going to say you can leave now, but please don't, because that would discourage me. So I was always taught, my father was a politician, and he taught me when making a speech, you tell an audience what you're going to say, you say it, and you tell them what you've just told them. So I think that's a good structural thing. So I'm going to tell you what I'm going to talk about tonight. The first thing I want to do is really paint for you an impressionistic picture of the changes that there have been in English education in the last 30 years, and particularly in the last 5 years. And I think from having talked to people earlier this evening, you will find this relevant if you're at a point of looking at your own public education system and thinking about what kind of reforms might make it better. And really, if you want the short summary of my lecture, is please don't look at England, because England is not a model, I think, for where you want to go. But perhaps we can discuss that. So I want to locate what's happened in England in both a national and a global context, because I think probably, although we're looking, England in this lecture, we're looking towards Europe, the truth is that we have more in common what's been happening in America. And really, I think what's been happening in America is in many ways quite shocking. I don't know if any of you follow the work of Diane Ravitch, but if you don't, some of you are nodding, please do. She's a wonderful writer, and I think it's very interesting that she started out as an advisor to George Bush the First. Do you remember the thinner one, the slightly taller, thinner, more intelligent one, I suspect? And then she turned against... it's funny also, you'll all laugh 2 minutes after my jokes because of the translation. But she has become a voice of conservation for good public quality education. And if I could in any way think of myself as contributing to that same debate in England and that same outcome, I would be very, very pleased. So I will be talking about what's happened in England, not the United Kingdom, because Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland have different systems. And I've visited Scotland, I'm married to a Glaswegian, I've debated with the Scottish minister, I think they're doing many good things. They have, as all education systems around the world have, problems that relate to the quality and inequality in their own societies. But they have not gone down the route of marketisation. Wales has equally not done that, but has been the... I don't know if this will translate easily, the whipping boy of the political right in England, because Wales has stuck by a fairly straightforward, comprehensive system, and every time their results come out, particular journalists who have an interest in attacking comprehensives or state education, they attack Wales. I think actually Wales is doing rather well now. Anyway, I'm not going to talk about them, but I just have. But the second thing I want to do is I want to challenge the narrative that is propagated by our government. At the moment, we have a Conservative government. They won a narrow majority in May, but they were in effect in power for 5 years from May 2010. And that was really when the revolution in our school system went on speed dial, if that makes sense in translation. It intensified. I think that it's led to a worrying picture of fragmentation of our system, of unhealthy competition, and a narrowed conception of learning and a widespread demoralisation among the professionals in our system, which means that this is a story that I think will eventually end badly. So, although I am going to talk about what's gone wrong, because I think it might be helpful to you, I also want to offer some hope too. I think the inherent weaknesses of our system, as I say, will lead, you know, what was the Marxist phrase, inherent contradictions, it will collapse. But at the same time, a lot of very hard work has been done over the years by those who have a different picture of how public education could look. A lot of head teachers have been working independently. There was an article, I read it on the plane over here, an article in The Guardian about a group of head teachers who are trying to come up with ways of improving our system different from the government ways. Our trade unions are quite active, and although they are under huge attack from the political right and the political centre, I think the trade unions have responded quite well in not only defending the interests of their members against the breakup of national pay and conditions and changes in the schooling system, but also in coming up with ideas for reform. And of course, in our country, there has been a huge political change in the last, where are we, October the 6th, in the last 6 weeks with the election of Jeremy Corbyn as the leader of the Labour Party. And I presume you've all followed that. Now, who knows where that's going to go? Who knows what's going to happen to the Labour Party? I've been a member of the Labour Party for longer than I should. My daughters, who are very radical, have just joined the Labour Party because of Jeremy Corbyn. For years, they told me that the Labour Party was a centrist, consensus-seeking, stale party, and they were right in a way. But now hundreds and thousands of young people have joined. And Jeremy Corbyn is very interested in education. And one of the things that he wants to do is set up a commission to look at a national education service in similar to our National Health Service. And our National Health Service is considered one of the great public institutions in our country, but also, I think, internationally. So I'm going to try and help Jeremy Corbyn in looking at what a National Education Service might look like, and I'm going to share some of those ideas with you tonight. So, three things. Where have we gone wrong? Two things, really. Where have we gone wrong, and how might we think about public education in a different way? Now, the way I think of what's happened in my country is that over the last 5 years, there's been a really tremendous and in some ways impressive but frightening kind of energy. And a very strange alliance has emerged and has taken over. When I say public education, I mean state education. So I shall use the term state education. And that alliance is an unholy alliance, if that term makes sense, between top-down, centralising government of the centre-right and a whole range of third sector, voluntary and increasingly private interests. And I call them many things. I write about them. I do try not to be too rude because, you know, courtesy is important in political debate. I call them the new educational evangelists because they have a sort of evangelistic energy. I think we have to credit them with sincerity. They believe that they've taken over a ailing and rotten public state education system, and they are transforming it. They're also called the New School Revolutionaries, and I'm going to refer to the changes that they have made as the New School Revolution, because I think that is a perfectly accurate term. Now, there are two origins of this New School Revolution. One is national and one is global. And the national one is really in what you might call the rise of neoliberalism, economic neoliberalism over the last 30 years. So that began with Margaret Thatcher, not Margaret Thatcher herself, but Thatcherism. We love isms in England. We have isms all over the place. Thatcherism, which was then succeeded by Blairism. And of course, Blairism was a very interesting ism in many ways. But one of the reasons that Tony Blair won in 1997, one of his key slogans was education, education, education. And the thing about Thatcherism was that it had a rather what now looks like an old-fashioned view about state education. She was obviously of the Tory party, leading the Tory party. Historically, the Tory party have not been that interested in state education. Most of them are educated themselves in what we call our private schools, which are elite institutions that educate the most affluent 7%. And there's an interesting story about how during the Second World War, before we had universal secondary education, When there was evacuation during the war, 1 million children were not in school. And when people said to the Tory government, the leaders of the Tory government at the time, well, why didn't you realise this? What was clear was that the Tory leaders had no idea what went on in state education because they lived in a particular bubble. So I think Thatcherism drew on that tradition. It wasn't very interested in state education. It looked down on it. It demonised it. It didn't resource it. And a lot of buildings were falling down during the 70s and 80s. And Tony Blair came along and said, we need to inject resources and hope into our state education system. And I remember voting for Tony Blair. I did vote for Tony Blair. And it was an incredible feeling, and a lot of that was about what he was going to do in education. And it did start well. It started very well. He cut class sizes to 30. He spoke in a positive way about teachers in our state system, which was something very new. And he introduced various strategies, which in the end became satirised because they were just a series of directives from number 10 Downing Street, which is where the Prime Minister, you know where number 10 Downing Street is. But they were, you know, his aim was to improve state education. But I think the neoliberal part of Blairism became more obvious, and it became more obvious in education with the beginning of what was called the Academy Programme. And the Academy Programme was an attempt to improve our inner city state schools in areas where there was tremendous sort of poverty and conflict and tension. But what Tony Blair did, and excuse my slight cartoon approach, I'm just trying to explain it, was he didn't believe that the public sector could reform itself. He didn't believe state education could reform itself. So he called in the private sector. So it became, at the beginning, people treated it rather like a joke. He was asking people who ran carpet warehouses. He was asking people who ran mobile phone companies. And he was saying to them, bring your entrepreneurial energy to our schools and make them work. And there was a lot of protest about it, but it did create some quite impressive schools in a way, because also there were new buildings and there had been a problem, and I think we have to be honest when we talk about our education system at any point about what the problems are. And there had been problems with discipline. There had been problems with poor results. And Blairism, let's not make it individual, Blairism put this tremendous energy, merged with these private companies, into certain schools, and they became model schools for a while. When Arne Duncan, who is an American reformer, flew into London, he was immediately taken over to Hackney in East London to see this marvellous school. And Blairism was very proud of that. But the trouble with Blairism and the trouble with the consensus that he built on was not that he wanted to improve state schools, but that he wanted to improve state schools by rejecting the expertise, the experience, and the knowledge of everyone who worked in state education. So if you are discussing how to improve your state schools, I would say to anyone who is leading or shaping that discussion, draw on the expertise of the people who know. Talk to the trade unions, talk to the municipal authorities, talk to the teachers, talk to the head teachers. That wasn't what happened in our country. There was a view that the Tories, who came into power in 2010, as I say, have just moved ahead with, a view that local authorities were terrible. They seemed to have two problems. They over-controlled schools, according to the government, and they didn't control them enough. You know, some people just can't win. Trade unions were a problem, and the political right particularly have a problem with trade unions. They thought that the teacher trade unions were guilty of what they call provider capture rather than consumer awareness, because, of course, parents were being recast as consumers rather than part of a neighbourhood or a collective project. They even, when the Conservatives came in, we're now jumping ahead to 2010, they completely decimated the teacher training system that we had, because they thought that universities were full of left-wing Marxists, well, Marxists are left-wing, but left-wing progressive, child-centred educators who just didn't have craft and discipline to create good education. And there was also a huge criticism of progressive education itself. And the other thing to say, and it is quite complicated, is that in 1960s and 70s, we had comprehensive reform. We had had a system that divided children up at 11, going to grammars or secondary moderns. There was a tremendous movement against that, and the majority of our country became comprehensive. Now, that's been the most politically contested reform, I would say, of post-war England. There is, within our society, and particularly among our elite who run politics and who run the media and broadcasters, a belief that our children can't go to school together. You know, they, and also a fear, particularly with growing religious and ethnic tensions, a fear about unified schooling. So all of those things fed into the neoliberal consensus in our country and created the new school revolution. But just before I talk a bit more about that new school revolution, I would just say, you know, that if the original aim was to improve public systems, I think if I look at my side of the school wars, and school wars is just a term, I think those of us who believed in good neighbourhood schools, those of us who believed in comprehensive education, non-selective schools, those of us who thought teachers were on the whole doing a good job, we weren't smart enough, we weren't quick enough to come up with our own plans for improvement. And that opened a space up for a mix of, you know, powerful government and new economic interest to come in and transform our system. I think the most worrying part of the new school's narrative in our country is its own certainty that it is progressive and egalitarian. Because what it argues, not so much anymore because there isn't that much evidence, it argues that traditionally state education let the poor down. It didn't give them enough knowledge. There's a tremendous debate in our country about a knowledge curriculum. I don't know if you've heard of the work of E.D. Hirsch, but E.D. Hirsch is an American thinker who says that there should be a common core of knowledge that all children draw on. And I think that's an interesting idea because I think it could be used for progressive or non-progressive ends. But again, this is an idea that the right, political right, have run, taken, and had some success with. And what they said was that our schools were knowledge weak and skills heavy, and that children were being taught how to work in projects or how to talk to each other. They weren't being taught about all the rivers of the world, all the capitals of the world. They couldn't do their times tables and so on. Personally, and I think that the debate has now landed at this point, all schooling is a mix of knowledge and skills. I mean, I haven't taught in secondary education, but I've taught in adult education. I just don't see why it has to be one or the other. But that's been a very important feature of our schooling. So the idea behind the new school revolution was that they would transform our schools and they would get children out of poverty through education. Poorer children would have access to a knowledge-rich curriculum, they would get good exam results, they would go on to higher education, and they would then go into an economy, which, as we all know, there aren't that many jobs, even for people who are graduates. So there's a lot of things that didn't quite add up. The final key part of our new schools revolution is privatisation. It's the most worrying part of the jigsaw. And it began, as I said, with the introduction of private companies and also third sector and voluntary groups and increasingly religious groups. And it accelerated. Oh, have I? Sorry, I've just lost my place. No. Yeah, so it accelerated with the academy program and so on. And now privatization is a real feature of our schools. You can't make a profit in English schools, but there is an enormous amount of money circulating around. Half of our schools have been taken out of municipal local authority control and are now being run either by religious organisations or by private companies. A lot of private companies don't make money directly from schooling, but they sell the school's services. A lot of people who run schools are earning more than the Prime Minister. I mean, actually, our Prime Minister doesn't earn that much in terms of private sector money, but there's a lot of money now in schools which there wasn't. And there's and the idea is that schools will compete, and they will compete on their results, and parents will choose on the basis of results, which I think is a very, very bad idea. Now, what's the vision? What's the actual vision behind this? What's the educational vision behind it? In preparation for this lecture, I read UNESCO's report that Val sent me, and it's very, very interesting to read. It's like entering a completely different world. It talks about the need for citizenship education. It talks about the need for children to understand what's happening in the environment. It talks about the need for tolerance and understanding of others. That completely contrasts with the vision that underpins the English system. Because if you have a highly competitive, individualised system where schools are competing and teachers are competing within schools to get better results, how can the vision of your system be anything other than highly individualistic? So the idea is just, it's now very much shaped around moving up the rungs, getting good results, and going on to higher education. And the attention, it's about all going to about going to universities, but of course our university system is now very, very hierarchical and stratified. You can pay up to 60,000 pounds to get a university education. If you go to a university like Oxford or Cambridge or one of the selective elite universities, you'll come out and you'll have a good chance of getting a job. But poorer children who tend to go to the lower ranked universities are still paying 50,000 or 60,000 pounds, and then they're coming out into a market where there's a glut of graduates. So it's perpetuating inequality rather than undermining it. And just talking about ranking, to give you an idea of how the system has developed, in some schools, in academy and free schools, which are part of the new schools that have emerged, they in the hallway, they will rank children. They will have a list of the children and who is the best and going down to who's doing the least well. I'm not quite sure how that relates to children changing, you know, scores change and so on. But there was even a discussion and a proposal by, I think it was Michael Gove, who was our education secretary, a very interesting character, that there should be national rankings and that you should publish a list of, I don't know how many, hundreds of thousands of school children, and you would know that Susan Brown was at the top and that some poor unfortunate child was at the bottom. I mean, what a terrible idea is that? If you think of education as being about, in my view, imagination, encouragement, hope, learning how to fail successfully, if that makes sense, how can telling children from the age of 8 or 9 or 14, you're the best, you're the worst, how can that be a good idea? So, terrible idea. Now, I've talked about the national context a bit. I just want to talk briefly about the global context before I come on to what I would like to see change. The global context really can be summed up by the acronym GERM, the Global Education Reform Movement. Now, in England, GERM is something nasty. When you feel unwell, you have a GERM. Germs circulate around your body. So in our case, we like, you know, those of us who oppose it think GERM is a very good term. But GERM is actually a powerful global movement that is bringing all these elements into education that I've talked about. So Pasi Sahlberg, who is a Finnish educator, has talked about the five key elements of the global education reform movement, and I think they are worth just mentioning. The first is standardization of education, centrally prescribed curricula with detailed and often ambitious performance targets, frequent testing of students, and test-based accountability. The second feature is focus on core subjects in school, in other words, on English, maths, and science. Basic student knowledge and skills in reading, writing, and mathematics are elevated as prime targets, and whole nation systems are now judged by how well they do in international tests, such as PISA, TIMSS, and PIRLS. The third characteristic is the search for low-risk ways to reach learning goals. That minimises experimentation, reduces use of alternative pedagogical approaches, and limits risk-taking in school and classrooms. The fourth globally observable trend is use of corporate management models. Education policies and ideas are lent and borrowed from the business world. This limits the role of national policy development and enhancement of an education system's own capability to maintain renewal. It also paralyzes teachers and schools' attempts to learn from the past. And the fifth global trend is adoption of test-based accountability policies. School performance, especially raising student achievement, is closely tied to processes of accrediting, inspecting, and ultimately rewarding or punishing schools and teachers. Success or failure of schools is often determined by standardised tests and public exam results. And that is certainly what is happening in America, where things have gone way ahead of where we are in England. And I think it's really, really very frightening. And it's also completely narrowing what children are learning, so that you have in some places virtual schooling where children are just sitting in front of computers learning how to master tests. I mean, that is so far from an idea of education as a public good or a social experience. But all of these things have come to England, and I won't go into it too much, but we have seen the narrowing of what children are encouraged to learn. Schools are judged on whether their students at 16 have done five academic subjects, English, maths, science, and a humanity. Now, that's fine. Nobody is against that. I don't think a school should be judged on it because, of course, it depends on what students they're taking in. But what has meant that a lot of our art-based subjects have dropped away. So I think there's been 20, 30% drop in art and drama and music and all the things that make life fun and meaningful and therefore make schools fun and meaningful. Our curriculum has been rewritten. There was a huge argument. Once upon a time, teachers and education professionals wrote curricula. In England, the politicians write curricula. And Michael Gove, this interesting man who thought he knew everything and was very articulate about it, decided to rewrite the history curriculum, to take away a lot of elements of world history, to return it to a quite traditional view of our island's history. A professor at Oxford said that it had just become a kind of pub quiz, that it was a really sort of lean and mean curriculum, but that's what we have. It's now prescribed how you teach reading through the phonics system, which those of you in primary education will know about, and teachers no longer have the capability to decide the best way to teach reading. And teacher training, I think it's one of the most depressing things, has been abandoned, well, not abandoned, has been shifted largely to the classroom. So I have a 21-year-old daughter. Some of her peers and friends are now going into teaching through, in America you have something called Teach for America. In England you have Teach First. And these are organisations that encourage students from elite universities to go into teaching or to give it a try for the first few years. And I have a problem with that, partly because I think teaching is a public service and I think people should enter it with a sense of wishing to stay. But there you are, you want to have good teachers. But they have training of 6 weeks in the summer and then they go into a classroom. And I think this development is taking our system away from the way it should have developed and the way it should have improved. I think we should have had longer teacher training. And I'll come back to that. So to come to the question that I've been asked to answer, I could have said so much more about our system, but you'll be grateful that I've said what I've said. Is public education at risk? And I think this is a very interesting question with an interesting answer. You know, at one level, even I would say no. When I say public education, I mean state education. I would say no in this sense. Education still remains free at the point of use, and that is very, very important, at least up to secondary level. I think university fees are a huge problem. However, I wonder for how long we will have free education. Already you have cases of schools that charge parents this and that for things, and there was an interesting case where the school that the Prime Minister and the Education Secretary sent their daughter, which is a highly successful London state school, rather selective but successful. Every parent that got a place was asked to write a cheque for £100. So you can see the creeping beginning of charges coming in. And we have the same discussion in the health service. Should people who don't go to their doctor, who miss an appointment, pay, and so on? And I think once you cut out the idea that this is free for all, you're going down a dangerous road. The second reason why we can say public state education is not at risk, because it is still, government does still decide the direction of education. Our local education authorities have been cut away, but government is still deciding. So that's a good thing. I think the third reason, interestingly, why we could be optimistic, and I'm trying to be balanced here, is because, to go back to my argument about a section of the Tory party, a section of the Conservative part of England, wasn't that interested in state education. Now there's a sense that it is a national project. It's a national project, but it's one that's been taken over by the new educational evangelists. So the jury is out there on that element of it. But that point about the Prime Minister sending his daughter to a state school, that's a new thing. You know, for a long time, Conservative politicians sent their children to the 7% of schools. So the other thing I want to say is that although there are all these negative changes, schools are human institutions, and there are still wonderful, hundreds of wonderful state schools and wonderful teachers and so on, and everybody's doing their best. And my children went to a local comprehensive. They absolutely loved it. They did well. They've come out, obviously I think this because I'm their mother, but they've come out really good, rounded citizens. Of course, family background is such a big part of how children do. So I'm going to end now by talking about what alternatives, what are the different ways of thinking about state education? And this is really to get a debate going with you. And also because a lot of us now are feeling that the new school revolution is running out of steam. We've got problems with teacher recruitment. There's a huge problem of overload. Teachers are working too hard. When the new education secretary asked teachers to tell her if they were feeling overloaded, 40,000 teachers replied to her email. I don't think she's actually done anything about it, but anyway, she asked them. There's problems of recruiting teachers in core subjects and so on. There's more and more scandals about financial mismanagement and corruption within schools. There's a lot of schools that were offered autonomy under the new system who are now struggling to survive. And a lot of the academy chains, which we were told were going to make schools really efficient and good, are not doing very well. And actually, when you look at the results of the academies and free schools, these new schools that the government have promoted, they are not doing any better in their own terms than the schools connected to the local authorities, the other kind of state schools. So how do we fight back? What's a new way of thinking about education? I do think the inherent weakness in the current system will catch up with them, but we have to have a richer and more positive vision to offer. So five key ideas for the future. You can tell I'm a politician's daughter. They always like to five. Firstly, I would like to see both nationally and across Europe and across the globe a different quality of conversation about our schools, because I think for the last 10 years it has all been about data and accountability. But one thing I'd like to see is to start with a simple and humble and human recognition there is a limit to what schools can do. Schools cannot solve inequality, and it is not fair to ask teachers to do so. People talk about Finland, which is a successful European system, although I think even that has slipped down the rankings, if you trust the rankings. But Finland's school system enjoyed what you'd call a virtuous circle. It started with lower levels of inequality, and its comprehensive school system has kept that equality going. If you look at England, we are a deeply unequal society. We always have been. You can't understand English society if you don't understand the class system. People say the class system is ended. That's nonsense. I'm here to tell you the class system is alive and well. It's just mixed up with a kind of consumerist American sheen, but it's still there. And for the new school revolutionaries to say to teachers and schools, the old state education system promoted inequality. It's up to you now to close that gap. It's an impossible pressure. So I think we have to accept the limitation of what schools can do. Secondly, and be more honest about it, secondly, I think we need to have, we need to debate a different conception of education itself. And this may in some ways be going back to earlier ideas, but revisiting them with the experience that we have. And the, you know, everything is a dialectic. And we've learned a lot from the change of the last 5 years. Some we may be able to retain, some we may be able to not get rid of. But the idea of education being just a series of outcomes rather than an experience, rather than thinking about quantity instead of quality, I think we need to start thinking again about quality. And I don't think that's very complicated. It's an abstract term. But it means restoring a broad and balanced and arts-rich curriculum. That's such an important part of education. And mixing that with some common curriculum in the more academic subjects. One of the more interesting ideas to come not out of the government but out of head teachers who've been gathering is a baccalaureate idea. The idea that every school should offer a mix that pupils should put together more of a programme of learning so that in the early years of secondary education, 11 to 14, pupils learn similar subjects, but then somebody who might want to go on to do a vocational subject might start to learn about plumbing or hairdressing, but continue to do philosophy as well. People would do voluntary service out in the community. There would be more individual projects. And in terms of a question that a very interesting and nice young journalist asked me earlier, it could provide a new form of accountability for our schools. Instead of looking at everything in terms of results, schools would have to say that this child has done 20 hours of community service, this child has written an essay on something that they really, really are passionate about, as well as doing exams and vocational qualifications and so on. So there is an imaginative way of looking at a high quality, rigorous school system that is more individual. The other thing is that we in state schools in England, we're always being told we should learn from the elite private schools. We're told that the thing that's good about elite private schools is that they are independently run, they're not controlled by government, they have unqualified teachers, which is another feature of our system. We now have unqualified teachers, which I think is a very bad idea. I think we could learn from our elite private schools in a different way. They show us the importance of small classes. They show us the importance of individual attention. If there has been a criticism of state education, and a fair one, it's that teachers haven't got the time and the energy to give individual attention to pupils. We need to bring that into the state system, and to do that, we have to have resources. Private schools have lovely buildings. Some of them have buildings that are like hotels I could never afford to stay in. For my book, School Wars, I went to visit a famous public school, which is an elite private school. I lost count of the things that they had. 16 football pitches, 2, their own drama studio. They were connected to Saatchi and Saatchi, the art dealers, on a website. They had 2 concert halls. It was just a picture of luxury. And it was so interesting. They also teach their students emotional literacy, in which one of the things the students have to learn is to defer gratification. And you look at what they've got and you think, they don't need to defer gratification. Their whole life is about being gratified. Anyway, these schools cost $35,000 a year, and very few people can afford it. I think money matters in the state sector. We're told it's not about money, it's about the kind of teaching. Money does matter. So all these things we need to think closely about. We also need to think about the importance of oracy as well as literacy. Learning to speak early on, learning to debate, learning to talk is a very important part of reinforcing intelligence and ideas and so on. The government has cut back the element of talk in our classrooms. They think it's idle chatter, children wasting time. But I know from my own experience, if I come and I talk to you, I learn more and my learning becomes deeper. I think we should be doing that throughout our state system. Thirdly, we need to return, but with new knowledge, to the idea of the good neighbourhood school. As a friend of mine who's campaigning against what's happening in America, he wrote to me very late last night. This is the trouble with email. You end up having conversations at 2 in the morning when you should be in bed getting ready to get your plane to Barcelona. And he said, schools are about developing the next generation, introducing the individual to the other, supporting strong communities and maintaining democratic values. In England, that's not the case. We believe education is best if you pay for it, or you travel to access it, or you compete to win it, or you defeat someone else in order to access it. What about returning to the idea of less choice and more of a rich educational experience locally as a human right? The kind of ideas that Diane Ravitch has put forward and that have seemed to work in Finland. And part of that means a highly trained, specialised and skilled teachers. Because that's another form of intelligent accountability. Instead of looking just at numbers, what about saying we really trust our teachers and we trust that they will give our children a good educational experience? We have travelled the other way, as I've said. We have unqualified teachers. We give our young people 6 weeks training. So, of course, we don't trust them. We look at the numbers. But let's not look at the numbers. Let's look at the human beings. Fourthly, I don't know we're going to be able to take back the tide of privatisation in England, but I think we need to bring schools into some form of democratic control. You can't have schools and certainly stop the for-profit tide that will happen if the Conservatives carry on. We've also cut back our adult and our further education, and our system is now a one-chance system. If you don't get your exams at 16 or 18, it's very hard to access education after that. To me, education is about lifelong learning. I came out of university realising how little I knew, and that began 30 years of learning. And I was what you would consider, you know, I succeeded in the school system. It is crazy to say that education is finished at 16 or 18. We have to have institutions and practices in place so that people can enter education at any point in their life. I think university is wasted on young people. I really do. I wish I could now go back to university at the age of 58, but I can't afford it. So that, I think those are my 5 ideas. They may have gone on to 6 or 7. We've got a big battle on our hands in England trying to get these ideas back into the public sphere. And one way we're going to do that, and it may be helpful when you're thinking about what reforms you want, is to come up with really sensible, well-tested, practical reforms that take forward our values. So maybe it's about talking less about the values, education as a public good, important as that is, and talking about the ways we're going to implement it. As I said, Jeremy Corbyn wants to set up a commission to look at a national education service, and I hope that he will not only look at the funding questions and the importance of free education, but we'll look at some of these really imaginative ideas that can take our system back to one that works for everyone and makes school an enjoyable and rich experience, which is what it should be. Thank you very much for listening to me. I look forward to the discussion.